From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome everyone to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
The thyroid gland, it's one of the body's control centers. It helps regulate things like heart rate and metabolism. When your thyroid is out of whack, it can cause problems throughout your whole body. We'll have an update on thyroid conditions, including thyroid cancer.
Also on the program, bloating, that swollen feeling in your belly. It's usually just a nuisance, but occasionally bloating can be a sign of something serious.
And about 25 million Americans report suffering from chronic pain. We'll talk about effective ways to manage this widespread condition.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Well, they don't always get a lot of attention, but the glands in your body, some of the glands you don't even know they're there, but they perform some pretty important essential tasks. They produce hormones that stimulate every organ system, regulating everything from how well you sleep to your overall level of physical activity to even sexual function.
The thyroid is one of those glands. It's shaped something like a butterfly, and it's located at the base of your neck just below your Adam's apple. Are you touching there right now? Everybody should be. Like the other glands in your body, it helps to manage several basic functions, including regulating your heart rate, how fast you burn calories, and other metabolic functions. And when your thyroid isn't working properly, you're not working properly.
Here to talk about thyroid problems, including thyroid cancer, is Mayo Clinic endocrinologist, Dr. Maria Stan. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Stan. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a small gland with a lot of big jobs.
It is probably, if you were to say, in ounces, is a third of an ounce. And indeed, it's shaped like a butterfly, and we can probably go into what thyroid means. Actually means shield in Greek, and that's where the name first derived. I guess the butterfly probably has to be reformed a little bit. But yes, it is small, but the thyroid hormones that are produced by this gland have implications throughout the body.
Can most people feel their thyroid gland?
Probably not.
If they know where to feel?
No, they'll probably choke before they get to feel the thyroid appropriately.
Whenever you get it tested, though, the doctor kind of gives you a drink of water and just touches your throat, so you must be able to feel it somewhat, but probably they know what they're doing.
So we're looking indeed to feel the part that's moving with swallowing that is in front of the windpipe, the trachea, because the thyroid does have that up and down movement with swallowing, so then it's easier to distinguish it from the surrounding tissues, the muscles that are right next to it. So, yes.
If you can feel it or see it, does that suggest that something's wrong?
That's a very good point. And actually it was considered for many centuries to be an element of beauty that the thyroid grows in pregnancy.
That's what you had.
Jeez. Didn't have anything to do with pregnancy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very beautiful. That's right.
Beauty was the idea. And actually it turns out that we're seeing that it grows when there's less iodine. And with pregnancy, the iodine needs go up. Hence, the thyroid struggles a little bit, and it grows, obviously, because it has to provide for more than one person at that point. And indeed, when you feel it, though, outside of the pregnancy, it's in need of attention, possibly.
So, tell us about this relationship between iodine and the thyroid. What do the two have to do with each other?
The thyroid hormones that we were mentioning earlier are composed of a structure that we known as protein, but on that scaffolding of protein, we need to attach iodine for the hormones to be active. And actually, we probably, many of us have heard T4 and T3 when we talk about thyroid. It relates to how many atoms of iodine are present in that hormone. So T4 has four atoms and T3, obviously,
is
a different number.
Is that why they came out with iodized salt? So we would hopefully get enough iodine in our diet?
Yeah, that's a very good point that the requirement for iodine was not met by our usual food intake until over the last few decades when the addition of iodine in certain foods has made so that now we have sufficient and the thyroid, as a consequence, does not struggle, does not become enlarged there are no more goiters, which used to be quite a common thing. If we talk with our grandparents, they'll recall people with large necks, and everybody knew that's a goiter.
And that was because they weren't getting enough iodine, so the thyroid was trying to enlarge itself, get bigger to actually produce
compensate.
Sort of, right.
The signal was stronger, you have to work harder, and as a response, the thyroid would, as we say, hypertrophy, that is, make bigger cells, more substance, but the final step still relies on having enough iodine. That wasn't there, the process was not effective. So,
well, it sounds like if there's iodine in the salt isn't a problem anymore, we should not be worrying so much. We shouldn't hear so much about the thyroid, but it seems like everybody has got problems with their thyroid. So what's going on? Where's the disconnect?
It is indeed.
It's job security, isn't it?
I think that's one way to look for it, but that's not for this audience. It's something that I think it's obviously has become more known after we had few presidents that had, unfortunately, problems with thyroid function. That brings it very easily, like any celebrity brings a medical problem into the attention of the public. So overactive thyroid is Graves' disease, and that's how that became quite known to all of us, that it can create irregular heartbeat after one of these episodes.
And overactive thyroid is hyperthyroidism?
Correct. Okay. Hyper means too much. Overactive. Graves' disease is when the whole gland produces at a high rate throughout the day, as opposed to what some people have heard of, toxic nodules or toxic goiter, when there are parts of the thyroid, be it one or multiple multinodular goiter, that have a change in their genetic structure that makes them overactive. Mm.
Is Graves just one form of hyperthyroidism? And why do they call it Graves' disease?
So Robert Graves is the first, well, there's still a debate between the Irish and the French and a German about who was the first, but bottom line is one of them, we think Robert Graves was putting together the fact that the heart goes fast, the people lose weight, and the thyroid is enlarged. So he connected these dots, and we later on found out that there's an increased production of thyroid hormone, hence the disease bears his name, Graves' disease. But I make a point to say it has no other relation with the word grave. It's a disease that we can treat very well these days. But this was put together about 1830, 1840, somewhere there. So we have a century and a half plus of history of Graves' disease.
You say that hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, which you spend a lot of your day working with patients, but it seems like the reason I always hear thyroid's getting the bad rap is people are having trouble because they can't lose weight. And they say, oh, it's about my thyroid, you know, whether they're diagnosing that themselves or not. That would be hypothyroid, correct? Do you end up gaining weight if you have a hypothyroid problem?
You mentioned very appropriately early on that the thyroid hormones play a role in metabolism. So how fast we burn calories is in part impacted by how much thyroid hormone we have. So as a consequence of that, if we do not have enough thyroid hormones, then yes, we will have a different balance on how many calories come in and how much we burn. And obviously, if we shift that balance to in favor of how many come in, then weight gain can occur. But I have to say the weight gain is rarely impressive. It's usually in the range of pounds, and it tends to be early on water retention as opposed to weight, solid mass. But it is likely that some people gain weight as a result of an underactive thyroid. How often it happens? Probably 5% of the population has the underactive thyroid.
We're talking thyroid problems with Mayo Clinic endocrinologist Dr. Maria Stan. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, myth or matter of fact, women are far more likely than men to have thyroid problems.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
We are with endocrinologist and thyroid specialist, Dr. Maria Stan from the Mayo Clinic. We've talked initially about where the thyroid is, some of the things that it does, some of the diseases that can affect it, and now time for myth or matter of fact.
Myth or matter of fact, women are far more likely than men to have thyroid problems. Is that a myth or a fact?
Fact. Women are unfortunately predisposed to more autoimmune problems, and that is the most common reason why the thyroid is underactive, autoimmunity.
All right, tell us about what that means, autoimmune, and is that Graves' disease or is that a different disease? Hashimoto's, or you've got so many diseases you've got to deal with. All right, autoimmune disease first.
So we all know how the immune system is protecting us from germs, foreign elements, bacteria, viruses. But immune disease can make mistakes. And in that process, sometimes it targets a part of our body as if it were foreign. So the thyroid in that process can be affected as the immune disease creates antibodies against the thyroid. And in, as a result of that, the thyroid gradually loses function over a number of years. And that gets us to the label of Hashimoto's thyroiditis. We have probably about 10 to 1 prevalence of this disease in women as opposed to men.
So the body has destroyed itself, in this case, just the thyroid gland, and that is called Hashimoto's. And you treat that, I assume, by replacing the thyroid hormones, which you can do quite easily, right?
That is a very good way of putting it. We do not see that this is a disease that spreads. It's a disease in which the thyroid becomes underactive. So the thyroid is not the guilty part, and it is bypassed in its function by our medical treatment with thyroid hormone, standard being what we call levothyroxine or T4.
And it's been around forever, and it's one of the cheapest drugs there is, right?
Both of those are accurate statements, but the forever probably has to be nuanced, but plenty of decades.
Yes. And then we talked about Graves' disease, and that's hyperthyroidism. How do you handle that problem? It's the opposite.
And that is probably the one that is more dramatic, that comes in a matter of weeks to months, as hypothyroidism seems to take years to settle in. So those changes with hyperthyroidism are fairly easy to notice. And people complain of difficulty following their usual tasks. There's difficulty concentrating, difficulty with fine movements of the hand. There's tremors, there's palpitations, trouble sleeping. And it's because there's too much thyroid hormone. So we dial it back with medications, or we eliminate the production altogether, either by removing the thyroid, which we usually do when the thyroid is very large, or by destroying the thyroid with radioactive iodine. So we're using the fact that the thyroid loves iodine, put the Trojan horse in the house, damage happens, but we, in our barbarian way of thinking, we think that we can control the levels much better by using levothyroxine, since we cannot control the immune system to stop this attack on the thyroid.
Huh, interesting. So you actually give radioactive iodine, so it's a form of radiation to the overactive thyroid gland that is localized to the gland, because the iodine doesn't go anywhere else in the body? Or it mostly goes to the thyroid?
It goes mostly in the thyroid. And obviously, one has to make sure that the iodine does not go into other places in significant amount, reason for which before the treatment, there is a scan in which we look where the iodine goes and how much percentage-wise goes in the thyroid. The damage is done on a range of 2 millimeters. So that's a tenth of an inch. That's as far as the radiation goes. So it's fairly directed therapy to the thyroid tissue.
What's at stake if you can't get the thyroid under control? Because it does take a while to get that levothyroxine level correct. It can be too much, too little. And if you can't manage your thyroid correctly, what ends up happening ultimately?
The part about too much thyroid hormone, that is the part where we're seeing significant consequences. And the most dramatic ones are that the heart, going at a very fast rate, loses strength. And the loss of strength, which we call in medical terms congestive heart failure, leads to buildup of fluid in the lungs as an extreme and difficulty breathing. What's noticeable to the patient is difficulty exercising. You're already at 100 beats per minute as you sleep. It's very hard to have enough energy during the day. So the heart suffers as a consequence of too much thyroid hormone. The bones suffer, and women are all mindful now about the osteoporosis. That is, if untreated, a consequence of hyperthyroidism, or it can be aggravated, I should say, by hyperthyroidism. At the other end, the hypo, there the consequences are more slowly to detect.
Quality of life type?
You are probably right in that having less thyroid hormone, there's less stimulation of the tissue. So there's probably decreased energy altogether, decreased ability to be as sharp as one thinks. I could be, but I'm not there. There must be something going on. And if there's an underactive thyroid, that is indeed a reason to at times underperform probably. Muscles seem to suffer. And as I said, there's a fluid gain and possibly some weight gain in some cases if it goes on for a long time.
Also important for our listeners to know that there's an easy way to monitor this, right? I mean, you have very good tests for total thyroid hormone and then the two that you talked about, T3 and T4, correct?
A very, very important point. They are looking at different aspects, and I explain this to patients as what the thermostat does to the furnace. So the TSH is the signal that the pituitary, our master gland at the base of the brain, sends to the thyroid. TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, the idea being there's not enough thyroid hormone, that signal goes up, stimulating the thyroid to produce more. And we would see that as a sign of hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid. If there's excessive amount of thyroid hormone, then the TSH would go down, a sense that the pituitary says there's too much in the system, you better stop working, I'm not going to stimulate. So values that are very low to sometimes undetectable are associated with hyperthyroidism. Of all these tests, this particular one, TSH, is the most reliable. And this is the one that we follow in the vast majority of people to decide how much thyroid hormone they need. And that is one that has caused question, why don't you look at T3 and T4? They are useful in the early phase when we make the diagnosis. Long term, the replacement therapy is unlikely to be influenced by these two parameters if the TSH is normal.
Pretty easy to follow your treatment modality by getting a periodic TSH. That'll tell you if the thyroid is working the way it should, not hard enough or too hard.
Or if the treatment is correct, yes.
We have about a minute left. What about thyroid cancer? Are people who have hyper or hypothyroids, are they more likely to get thyroid cancer?
There are a few judges that are still holding out on making that decision. It is probably, at a big scale, inconsequential if there's hypo or hyperthyroidism in increasing or decreasing the risk of thyroid cancer. And thyroid cancer, we're seeing more of it probably as a result of our more aggressive use of technology these days, in which lesions that would have been discovered 10, 20 years later, or probably never, are now coming up because we looked at the carotids, we looked at the spine, we looked at the brain, we looked at the lungs, and I can go on. And we find this half an inch lesions or a quarter of an inch lesions that now we have to give an answer about. And many times this thyroid cancer, as we're starting to learn, is not one that will affect life expectancy or quality of life. So we have to step back a little bit and see what's the benefit and what is the risk of our approach.
So most cases of thyroid cancer are fairly indolent.
That is a correct statement. And we're talking, to be more specific, this is one of the four types of thyroid cancer. We're talking papillary thyroid cancer, but this is more than 80%+ of cases. And of those, the majority are probably indolent.
That's a good thing. Dr. Marius Stan, he's an endocrinologist and a thyroid expert, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, bloating is a common problem that's usually nothing to worry about, but there are times when it's a sign of something more serious.
And about 25 million adults in the U.S. suffer from chronic pain. We'll talk with a pain management specialist about getting help.
Do you have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at #MayoClinicRadio or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Statins, the drugs used to lower bad cholesterol, have been in the news a lot lately. Should you take them?
The studies have shown that they are beneficial, and the statins are beneficial to lower heart attack. And the higher your risk, the more the benefit.
Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Stephen Kopetsky says statins benefit four groups of people: those who've had a heart attack or stroke, diabetics, those at high risk of cardiovascular disease, and people with a gene that makes them produce too much cholesterol. Dr. Kopetsky says statins can cause some side effects, the most common one being muscle aches. So talk to your healthcare provider to see if you should be on a statin. Now, speaking of heart health, you no doubt have heard that a Mediterranean diet that's rich in veggies, fish, and olive oil is good for your heart. Well, research suggests it may also reduce your risk of breast cancer. Listen to this. The American College of Sports Medicine says 25,000 people sprain their ankle every day. Sure, you recover, but those sprains are not simple or run-of-the-mill injuries. Here's Mayo Clinic sports medicine specialist Dr. Ed Laskowski.
It shows that there is an effect after an ankle sprain that's lasting on the muscle and on the balance system, the stability system.
Dr. Laskowski emphasizes that exercises to strengthen muscles around the joint are key to long-term recovery. And now let's talk about fatty foods. Vanderbilt University researchers found a defective brain signal causes mice to eat too much of it, leading to obesity. They say figuring out how the brain balances what you eat could fight obesity in people. And can you guess what kids' favorite fruit is? Apples. They like them, and they are a healthful treat, so says a study in the journal Pediatrics. For more health news, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Bloating. You know, the buildup of gas in your stomach. You have
it's the worst. Yes.
Your stomach and your intestines. It can cause anything from mild discomfort, which lasts just a few minutes, all the way to sharp, intense pain that may last for hours. Bloating isn't usually an indication of a serious problem. You know, passing gas or having a bowel movement often is all that's needed to resolve it, or maybe just a good burp.
But sometimes, Tom, bloating is a sign of a more serious condition or reaction. Here to explain the causes of bloating and when it can be something that's serious is Mayo Clinic gastroenterologist Dr. Jean Fox. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Fox.
Thank you for having me, Tracy and Tom. It's great to be here.
If you were to believe commercials that you see on television and in print and wherever all over the place, bloating and not having a flat belly, and it's just one of the worst things that's ever happened, and it seems to be everywhere. Is bloating that common of a problem?
It's fairly common. I'd say I see a patient multiple times a week for the symptom of abdominal bloating.
And they come in and they say, I'm bloated.
Yeah, I'm bloated, or I'm full, or I feel distended.
Men or women or both?
Both. I'd say I probably see women more commonly for this symptom, but I do see men for this problem as well.
How can you tell when it's something that's minor or when it's something more serious?
Usually by the time they come to see me for it, it's really had a significant impact on their quality of life because they've probably already been to see their internist about mm-hmm. it. And so it's troublesome. It's troublesome enough that they've taken time off of work and made an appointment.
And it's not just the bloating, it must be pain associated with the bloating that brings them in to see you, right?
Often they complain of pain or an uncomfortable full feeling often after eating.
This goes along with the awareness of ovarian cancer. Because as women, you know, we're learning so much more about ovarian cancer. And one of the first things that you'll hear about that is, well, if you've got a fullness feeling or bloating, that could be part of ovarian cancer. Do people come in and say, do I have ovarian cancer?
Well, you're right. That's one of the things that people might be worried about, that they have ovarian cancer specifically or some abdominal cancer in general. Yes, and unfortunately, because ovarian cancer does have such nonspecific symptoms, it's sometimes hard to reassure patients. So one of the things that I do make sure of when women come in complaining of abdominal bloating is whether or not they're up to date on their GYN exams.
Gotcha.
So what are the common causes that you see resulting in the problem of bloating?
Well, often it's either what people are taking in. They're taking in too much of something that's causing the bloating, or some dietary or lifestyle habits, or they're not putting out. They're constipated.
Okay. So are there gassy foods?
Well, there are foods that people typically think of as gas-producing foods, such as onions and
beans.
Cabbage and cauliflower and beans. But then there are also foods that are poorly absorbed, certain sugars that might be poorly absorbed by some people, such as fructose, and high fructose corn syrup is very ubiquitous in our diet now, and some people don't absorb it well, and that can produce gas. Some of the non-absorbable sugars that are found in sugar-free gums or sugar-free or diet beverages.
One of the questions I have to ask, because this affects in my house, I want to know why I can eat one meal at one part of the day and then have the leftovers the next day. At one, the first time I eat it, no problem. The second time I eat it, it makes me feel bloated and it gives me a gas. So what's the difference? What's happening there?
So it may not necessarily be food you're ingesting. There could be more than one thing going on. Mm-hmm. It could be that there's something that you're ingesting along with the food, or it could be the way you're ingesting it. If you're eating your lunch in a very, very hurried fashion,
you're eating too
fast.
We
tend to swallow more air.
Wow.
Yes, and that will contribute to bloating.
Are there any other simple things such as that, you know, eating too quickly that people could be aware of?
Drinking out of a bottle, like a soda bottle or a water bottle, a small necked bottle, causes you to swallow more air, and of course, carbonated beverages.
Are there other things that more serious causes for bloating other than, let's say, cancer of the ovary that you see?
Well, you know, usually bloating in and of itself is not caused by something that's life-threatening or very ominous, unless there are other symptoms that are going along with it, such as vomiting unintentional weight loss or things of that nature.
I was thinking of things like colon cancer or irritable bowel syndrome or possibly celiac disease that you pick up with the first symptom might be bloating.
So celiac disease is a tough one because, again, the symptoms of celiac disease can be somewhat nonspecific. Often those patients will have diarrhea associated with bloating or other types of abdominal pain, but it's conceivable that they may present initially with bloating, and that's something that can be ruled out with a simple blood test.
Some of those advertisements that I've seen, you know, they are selling a pill, saying that, you know, you take this pill and then it helps get rid of your gas. What is it that those people are selling, and is there any pill that you can take that will help take care of bloating?
I think some of the pills that you might be referring to might be laxatives, and then there are some pills that are basically charcoal-based, I think, or simethicone, that don't really have a lot of evidence behind their efficacy. Some patients report that they find them to be of benefit, and I don't think that they cause any harm, but I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support their use.
Yeah, a couple that you see at the drugstore are Malanta Gas and Gas X. Do those help people?
I've had patients report that they've found some benefit from them. I've had others report that they haven't been helpful at all. And again, there's not a lot of evidence to support their use, but I would say they're benign. There's nothing detrimental that they're going to cause. So I think if somebody tries them, they find them to be a benefit, it's fine to continue them.
Back to that simple list that we started, which is don't eat so fast, don't drink out of a bottle, maybe
or
use a straw. Don't use a straw either.
No, bottles or straws can both cause bloating.
Carbonated beverages.
Avoiding carbonated beverages.
What else?
Smoking is a big one.
Really?
Yes. People who smoke are more likely to complain of abdominal bloating. And that's a tough one because most people who smoke don't want to quit or having a hard time quitting in the first place. So
any other simple things that people can try?
Well, obviously avoid the foods that cause it, like beans and you said broccoli and cauliflower and all that stuff that's good for you.
They're different for different people.
Is that
and
right?
I don't want people not to ingest those foods.
Yeah.
I don't want people not to eat their broccoli. But
well, that's what I mentioned. Sometimes broccoli does and sometimes it doesn't. That's what I thought is weird.
Doesn't. And so that might be, as I was saying, something else that you're ingesting with it, or there you might have a little bit of an irritable bowel, in which case it's not necessarily the broccoli, because you might have symptoms on one day eating broccoli and not have symptoms on the next day. And it might be, as I said, other things you're eating with it, or there could be a constellation of things that are going together to cause that. And
it makes it kind of hard to pin down.
Yes. Simple things to try eliminating at home might include, you know, the high fructose corn syrup, the non-absorbable sugars that are found in like the zero calorie foods and beverages, and maybe lactose elimination for a short period of time. But if you're not able to easily discern it at home before you really start eliminating and making your diet very, very restrictive, I would go and seek medical attention and try to discuss it with your doctor and try to figure out a more scientific way to eliminate and reintroduce things so that you're not ending up with a very restrictive diet. Because sometimes people do, out of desperation, they start eliminating things, and then before you know it, they're not eating much of anything at all.
Thanks, Dr. Fox, for explaining the causes and the cures for bloating. Dr. Jean Fox is a gastroenterologist at Mayo Clinic.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, chronic pain is one of the most common problems for which people seek medical treatment. We'll talk with a pain management specialist about finding relief.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Chronic pain. Ouch.
Yeah.
Chances are you either have it or know someone who does. In fact, a recent analysis published in the Journal of Pain, probably not one you subscribe to.
I try not to read it, no.
The Journal of Pain found that more than 25 million adults in the U.S., that's about 10 or 11% of the population, they reported having chronic pain in the previous 3 months.
But just what is chronic pain, and is it pain associated with a disease like cancer or arthritis, or is it pain of unknown origin that just won't go away, or is it both? Here to answer those and other questions about the diagnosis and treatment of chronic pain is Dr. Jason Eldridge. Dr. Eldridge is an anesthesiologist and pain medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic. Welcome to the program, Dr. Eldridge.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Eldridge, good to have you. So an anesthesiologist, meaning you give anesthesia, or you used to, but do you still do that in addition to your pain work, or are you strictly a specialist in pain management?
No, I'm double boarded in pain medicine and anesthesia. My practice is only pain medicine.
Interesting. So you're really not in the OR?
That's correct. And most of the practitioners here at Mayo Clinic are full-time pain medicine.
So from your standpoint, in lay terms, how do you define chronic pain? How do you label someone as having the condition?
Well, there are various markers used in the literature. The most common milestones, if you will, would be 3 or 6 months of chronic unrelenting pain for the majority of that time span. The paper referenced earlier in the program looked at a three-month time span. But commonly, 6 months is probably used as a definition.
25 million adults, 11% of the population. Would you agree with those numbers?
I would. In fact, I think those numbers could be conservative. There are prior epidemiologic studies which indicate the prevalence may be 10 to 50% of the population based on the country that's studied.
You probably don't have many open slots on your calendar.
Well, for sure. Demand for my services outstrips supply.
So there are different types. I mean, you get all sorts of patients who present to you. And where do most of your referrals come from? They don't come directly, do they?
No, we get a lot of referrals from a spine center. Of course, we also work shoulder to shoulder with our spine center colleagues. But I'd say the vast majority of our consults come from the primary care referral base.
And you mentioned from the spine center. And tell us, from your standpoint, are there certain areas or parts of the body where chronic pain is more common? And, of course, I'm thinking of back pain and headache.
Right.
You must see a lot of people with back pain.
No, I think back pain by far is the single most common entity for the chronic pain patients we see.
Well, I just was going to say for back pain, so then does that qualify as muscular pain or nerve pain, or how do you break it down?
Yes, all of the above. Commonly I think there usually is a myofascial component, but typically it's more than one thing. It's
myofascial?
Myofascial meaning muscle and or the connective tissue surrounding muscle. But as you imply, it's usually not one singular cause, but a multitude of causes.
Yeah, so back pain being as common as it is and frustrating for so many people, and surgery is not often the answer, or often is not the answer for back pain. So they come to see you, and what percentage of these patients can you truly help, and how do you do that?
Well, as you mentioned, surgery is a viable therapeutic tool for a number of patients, but we try to proceed with the less aggressive options first because the reality is most people with pain, especially acute or subacute pain, will do better on their own with conservative therapy for about 3 months.
So unless it's a disc or something that clearly can be helped by surgery, really you want to try to avoid surgery on your back if you can, right? Wouldn't you say in general that's true? Obviously, there's something that's easily fixable, like a disc pressing on a nerve, and it doesn't get better, you want to have the surgery. But surgery on the back is not always successful.
I think that's fair to say. I think that for most patients, We try to do something that's not invasive but gives them a better chance to recover on their own because the long-term outcome appears to be best in that context. That being said, we use pharmacologic tools, interventional
medications.
Tools. Medications, yep. Several different pharmacotherapeutic strategies. And then, of course, we use interventions like percutaneous injections. Surgery, of course, would be a tool. There are other implantable techniques like spinal cord stimulation for esoteric, difficult-to-treat type cases. And then, of course, there are all sorts of non-conventional or complementary alternative techniques that are growing in popularity.
Such as?
Well, acupuncture would be a common one that it now has, I think, mounting and cogent evidence for efficacy in the right patient population. But there's a variety of other associated complementary techniques.
It's acupuncture, so you really think it works. You're a believer.
Well, I think that it's hard to argue with the evidence. And there are some published data that shows that for chronic pain states, it's very unlikely to do harm, number one. And number two, it does show efficacy in the right patient population.
And how do you know where to put the needle?
Well, I'm not a practitioner of acupuncture myself. That's a viable question. But I'll have to refer to my other more experienced colleagues.
So they know where to put the needle.
They know where to put the needle.
You just refer them
It has
them
to do
over.
With meridians and things way above my pay grade.
He can refer you, Tom.
That's right.
Hey, how do you assess the chronic pain? I mean, I'm thinking of the little smiley face chart of 1 to 10. Is that how you determine? Because everybody's 1 to 10 is going to be different.
Well, so, yeah, you hit upon one of the dilemmas in assessing pain, and that is that it's inherently subjective. And because of that, there is some art to the science in determining how intense it really is. And usually what we try to do is classify the pain as either nociceptive, meaning that it's not neuropathic overtly, or neuropathic pain. Because what's causing the pain gives us some idea as to which sort of therapeutic strategy they may respond best to.
When you talk about pain medications, do you try to avoid narcotics in most patients with chronic pain? It seems like everybody's taking oxycodone. So who's
right.
giving it out? Is it in the
depending on who you talk to, oxycodone should be in the water. I think in general, opioids really should be used in a constrained manner. They can be a very viable therapeutic tool. But only if used in a time-limited basis. I can't stress enough that pain is not equivalent to an opioid-deficient state.
Now, when you say opioids, tell us exactly what you mean.
When I say opioids, I mean really morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, fentanyl, that class of drug.
Narcotics. Addicting medications.
That's right.
So you were saying pain is not equal to the lack of those opioids?
Well,
is that what you
pain
said?
Is not an opioid-deficient condition. There has been a thought in some circles that if you have pain, that you must necessitate an opioid as a therapy. And I think really the pendulum now is swinging the other way. And if you look at the long-term outcome data with chronic opioid use, there's very little data for efficacy, but there is a lot of data on enhanced risk, comorbid conditions, decreased functional status, increased depression, things of that nature. So time-limited use for the right indications, opioids are a wonderful tool. But long-term chronic use, much less certainty about efficacy, and probably much more risk of harm in most patients.
All right, you've talked about medication. You've talked about surgery as an option, fortunately, for some patients, but not all. You talked about acupuncture. We've got about a minute remaining. What are some of your other modalities that you have used that you found particularly effective?
Well, I think where chronicity is concerned, perhaps the most important intervention is really a team approach, a multidisciplinary approach that uses more than just pills, more than just injections, more than just surgical interventions. And really what I'm headed towards here is cognitive behavioral therapy and other psychological tools that can help people with difficult days without utter reliance upon injections or pills.
Thanks for the update. Obviously a problem that affects a lot of people, 10 to 12% of the population. Dr. Jason Eldridge, anesthesiologist and pain medicine specialist, Mayo Clinic.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's our program for this week.
For more information about topics discussed today, visit us on the web at Mayo Clinic News Network, where you can access a podcast of today's show, previously aired programs, and the latest news from Mayo Clinic.
Have a question about health and medicine for one of our Mayo Clinic experts? Tweet us anytime at #MayoClinicRadio or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. We'll be answering your questions in upcoming programs.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Rich Dietman. Our social media editor, Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.